Hello and welcome to another episode of the Chinese History Podcast. My name is Yiming Ha. Today's guest is Lin Strube, an Emeritus Professor of History and Emeritus Professor of East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University Bloomington. Her research interests include traditional Chinese history, 17th century political and intellectual history, East-West comparative thought, and Chinese reference and source materials. Over the course of her career, she has published widely, particularly on the period of the Ming-Qing transition, and has received numerous awards. Her representative works include Voices from the Ming-Qing Cataclysm, China in Tiger's Jaws, The Southern Ming, 1644 to 1662, The Ming-Qing Conflict, A Historiography and Source Guide, and, more recently, The Dreaming Mind and the End of the Ming World, which was awarded Best Overall Book in Ming Studies, published between 2019 and 2022 by the Society for Ming Studies. So welcome, Professor Strube. Thank you for coming to the interview.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's an honor.
So you've worked extensively on this period in the mid-17th century that we call the Ming-Qing transition. It's not exactly a very happy time in Chinese history. There is famine, war, pestilence, and there's a lot of people that died or became forcibly relocated elsewhere. But underneath all that, there was still cultural production going on. The intellectuals, men and women, were still writing, they're producing. So I just want to start off by asking you, how did this Ming-Qing transition affect the intellectual landscape in China? What were some of the key changes in thinking or cultural production during this time?
It was a very interesting time to be alive, but I often wish my friends to have a boring life. Interesting things can also be extremely stressful, and that was certainly the time, the case in 17th century China. I would draw a contrast, although if there's a danger of overdrawing a contrast between the late Ming and the early Qing. The late Ming was a time of a lot of openness, emphasis on subjective understanding, subjective feeling, emotion, intuition, emphasis on individuality and individual expression. And this gave rise to just a plethora of new developments in the culture. Very exciting for modern historians to look back upon. But it was also a time of a lot of stress, social change, all of the looming problems that you've brought up, including climate change, as Timothy Brooks' new book has made more vivid for us. And then, of course, there were all of the tensions within the government, the factionalism. It was a time just ripe for big blow-ups. And things did blow up very disastrously in a number of ways in the course of the very middle of the century. And the long-term outcome of that was a shift toward more conservative attitudes in scholarship and society and government. But as is often the case, the previous developments were not completely lost. They were often worked into the undergarment, you might say, of the outer garment of greater conservatism. In the post-conquest scene of the very early Qing, there was an intellectual movement toward more concentration on objective learning, a turning away from Yangming thought, the thought of Wang Yangming from the 15th century that had been so central to the liberal attitudes and thinking of the late Ming, turning away from that, turning back more to the orthodoxy, the previous orthodoxy of Juxi and Juxi learning from the Song, and even letting go of the Cheng brothers, of the Chengzhu dyad and letting go of the Cheng brothers as too liberal and focusing very much on what I call Juxiism in the early Qing. Scholars became much focused on ritual and studying the past and discussing the present to come up with better understanding of how to order society, order legitimate government, how to strengthen lineages. All of these developments were more characteristic of the early Qing. So, and I think one can probably point to many analogous developments in world history for Americans who have some sense of 20th century American history. We had the blazing 20s and a tremendous burst of creativity in the very early 20th century. Some of those social developments went a little on the wild side, but then we had a couple of decades of warfare and a lot of sacrifice and a lot of deaths. And how do we emerge then in the 1950s? We have very popular television shows like Leave It to Beaver and the Lawrence Welk Show and the Mickey Mouse Club and the social orientation towards suburbia and the settled life and everyone with their own home and picket fence, that sort of orientation. So if you have any sense of that, perhaps you need to be a little older like me to have a sense of that. But one can find analogies in one's in American history for, of course, not exactly the same kind of change, but it was, as I say, analogous and can be understood, I think, even for someone not familiar with Chinese history, if you have some sense of modern American history, you can have some grasp of what the 17th century went through.
I see. So I have a quick follow-up question to that, because you mentioned that in the early Qing, there was a turn away from Wang Yangming and more towards the orthodox Zhuxi line of thought. Do you think that was because the intellectuals of that period blamed Wang Yangming thought for the problems that were going on? Because I'm just thinking, and I don't know if this is an apt comparison, because in the Southern Song, there was this huge reaction against Wang Anshi, whom they blamed for the collapse of the Northern Song, and there was a huge pushback against his thought and his ideology. Would you say that there was something similar going on in the Ming-Qing transition as well?
Yes, absolutely. And along with the rejection of Yangming thought, of course, it wasn't immediate. There were still plenty of pro-Yangming thinkers in the early Qing who were arguing their cause, but they were swimming against a tide. And eventually they were overwhelmed by the tide of a return to more conservative Zhuxi thinking. Of course, in Zhuxi's own day, he was not the conservative. He was the rebel. But of course, his thought became designated as the official line for the civil service examinations during the Ming. So Zhuxi was very much orthodoxy in the end of the Ming. But along with Yangming thought, out the door went some particular strains of Buddhism that became very influential among the intellectuals in the late Ming. Something that hasn't been studied very much is the effects of revival of the Weishi, the consciousness-only school, and certain aspects of that school in the late Ming, rediscovery of it. And this contributed a lot in concert with Yangming thought to the emphasis on the subjectivity of the mind and the interest in completely subjective thinking. Of course, one of my recent books was on the dream culture that developed tremendously during the late Ming and was actually helped by the Qing conquest because people had so many dreams and nightmares about the experiences they had and so many memories through their dreams of what they went through. But that was very much blamed later in the early Qing for just too much freedom, too much navel contemplation, neglect of the more objective problems of the people and the society and the government, more selfish pursuit of political aims, that sort of thing.
Your work on dreams is, I think, very interesting, just because I haven't really come across anyone else who did something like that. So I was wondering if you can talk more about this dream culture that starts to develop during this period. So people were dreaming and then they were writing down the stuff they were dreaming about. Is that what was going on?
It was somewhat more than that. It was also an interest in what dreams are. What is going on And it was very much a part of these issues of mind. What is mind? And an attunement, again, to the subjectivity of knowing and the positive and negative that comes along with that attunement to the subjectivity of knowing. On the one hand, it very much validates individual perspective and individual intuition. On the other hand, it undermines collective understanding of what's going on and what needs to be done. But yes, it was very much a part of that emphasis on subjectivity. And it was, especially by the Buddhists, it was always pointed out that when you're dreaming, that is your reality. And so how do you distinguish between the sense that you are comprehending reality when you're, quote, awake, unquote, and your sense that what you're sensing is reality when you're dreaming? How do you distinguish between those two? For the Buddhist, the bottom line was that there is no distinction. This whole existence of ours is a dream, and we only can awaken from this dream through Buddhist enlightenment. From the point of view of people who are not quite so much into the Buddhist line, dreams became a source of inner understanding. I think many modern people, what do you think about when you are able to remember your dreams? How do you look on them? Do you look at them for clues to your psychological state, to your emotional state? Do you think that someone from the beyond or something from the beyond is communicating to you through your dreams? In other words, what do you make of your dreams? There was a very high sense that it was important to think about these things and to remember one's dreams and, if possible, to write them down and to meditate on them, think about them, discuss them with friends who also were interested in their dreams. And it permeated really all aspects of the intellectual culture of the time. You can see it in something I wasn't able to address in my book because it was already way too long. The garden culture, of course, poetry was tremendous in the poetry of the day. When I would go into someone's wenji, their collected works, to look for material, there were only two categories of material in intellectuals' collected works that I knew I did not need to look at. And those were Memorials to the Throne and their civil service examination essays. But I could find material on people's reflections on dreams and dreaming and every other part of the intellectual endeavor of the time. And it was very much brought about by the climate of the late Ming, going back to the last quarter of the 16th century.
That's so interesting. But I guess the other big factor that would have affected intellectual production in this period was the fact that the Qing were created by non-Han Chinese Manchu people. And so how did the Han Chinese intellectuals square with that, the fact that we have these non-Chinese people now coming in to rule China?
It was extremely difficult to square that, as you put it, very difficult to square with that, especially since, of course, the Manchus didn't just wake up one morning and invade China. They expanded in the Northeast, what in the West, many people still call Manchuria, for a long time. And they had a lot of contact with Han Chinese culture in the Chinese Northeast, far Northeast. And they came from a mixed economy. They weren't like the Mongols that were completely on horseback and only did herding. The Manchus came from a mixed economy. They were familiar with agriculture. And they were gradually, as they took over more and more parts of southern Manchuria, they became more and more familiar with Han culture. They captured or brought in increasing numbers of Han Chinese, highly literate Han Chinese who worked for them in administrative capacities. But still, in the early phases, there were multiple Mongol and Manchu invasions of North China before the ultimate one of 1644. And there were many, several of those incursions by the Manchus. They knew the terrain they were looking at. But the first couple of decades of what I call Manchu Qing rule in China were very difficult. And of course, the warfare continued. It took a long time for them to completely subjugate all the resistance in South China. And there was a tremendous amount of brutality involved, perpetrated on all sides, but especially very selective perpetration of brutality by the Manchus. So it was all very hard to swallow. And of course, the Ming Dynasty had been founded and took great pride in having restored Han Chinese rule to China, having gotten rid of the Mongols. And the Mongol Yuan period was the first time in all of Chinese history that the whole subcontinent had been conquered by a basically pastoral horseback riding people who didn't have much knowledge of or respect for traditional Chinese civilization. The Mongols were looked back on as a great shame and something that should never happen again. And this was the great pride of the Ming, that they had forced the Mongols out and restored proper majority Han Chinese rule to China and restored all of the traditions and civilization itself to China. So to have this happen again was just, it was just dumbfounding and left the Chinese intellectuals, especially the governing class, the political class, it left them just with a feeling of tremendous guilt and helplessness and mutual recrimination that took a very long time to overcome. And certain elements within the, what I call the Manchu Qing government, worked hard to overcome this aversion and tremendous rejection and upset over the state of affairs. But then they were often, especially during the first couple of decades of Qing rule in China after 1644, they were very much in competition with other elements that thought that what was needed was a hard line and suppression of the Han Chinese resistance. So it took decades, and it made the century even more interesting for those of us who did not have to live through it.
But, you know, as was the case with the Yuan, when the Song fell, a lot of literati refused to serve in the government and they become recluses, or they went back to their homes and they just became scholars. They wrote. And I know the same happened after the fall of the Ming as well. A lot of these people refused to serve with the Qing government and they started writing. What were they writing about?
Right now, for instance, I'm working on Huang Zongxi. And you probably have heard of Huang Zongxi.
Yeah.
He wrote. He refused to take official appointment under the Qing, although in his very long life, he lived to 1685 or 1695. His lifetime pretty much spanned the whole 17th century. So he had decades of life left to him after the 1640s and 50s, during which he was very much a part of the resistance to the Qing conquest. And in the 50s, he decided he needed to devote himself mainly to the welfare of his family. And so he left the resistance, but still he didn't dare have anything to do with Qing officialdom in the 50s and the very early 60s. But it became harder and harder to achieve his goals. And he realized that if he were going to be absolutely never take official appointment under the Qing, then how else can I fulfill the obligations of a man of my class? That is, a man of the Shi class, the Shi Daifu class. He was very conscious of that. And of course, making up in his own life for the heinous state murder of his father during the late Ming. He had a very strong drive to complete what he saw as his father's mission to bring proper governance to the country, a mission for which his father was executed, but very unfairly. So Huang was a good example of a man with a very strong self-consciousness as a shi, whose purpose of being alive and being of the class and having the skills that he had, his whole purpose was to somehow serve and make the world better. For him, that was to contribute his historical insights on governance, which he wrote out in the form of this book called The Mingyi Dai Fang Lu, which you've probably heard of. Oh, I translated as Awaiting the Light, which is down to this day a very widely read document from that century. But he did a great deal more. He was a disciple of Liu Zongzhou, who was a very important Confucian philosopher in the late Ming, who committed suicide during the conquest. He took very seriously the responsibility of being the only survivor of Liu's school who really understood the teacher's teachings, which were in the vein of somewhat critical of, but also in the vein of Yangming learning. And he took extremely seriously the responsibility to continue to propagate the proper understanding of Liu Zongzhou's teachings. He compiled huge collections of Ming literature. And of course, there's the Ming Ru Xuan, which is this huge compilation of the works of the Confucian thinkers of the Ming period, which are, all of these are, of course, tremendous resources for us in the present day. One can criticize them, of course, like one can criticize all past materials, but this was how he strove to fulfill his obligation as a shi, while not taking government office. But he found, as he went out again into the world, that he couldn't pursue these goals without having the association with, the protection, the patronage, the intellectual stimulation with, and the protection of Qing officials. And he accommodated that in his life. He was able to attain these goals of his so stunningly because he tried to finesse this relationship with Qing officials in order to accomplish his goals without himself accepting official appointment under the Qing. And he took a lot of criticism for this sort of accommodative stance, but he was far from alone. Also, and you bring up the Song analogies were everywhere among the so-called Ming Yimin. And I would restrict the term Yimin, that is leftover people from the Ming, to those who refused to serve the Qing in principle, and in fact, refused to serve the Qing. Those people from the Song analogy were considered then to be proper Yimin. The term Yimin is very ancient. It comes from the Zhuan, or I'm not quite sure, I've forgotten, but it's a very ancient term. But in ancient times, it simply meant leftover people, people who from a previous state who continued living on under the rule of a succeeding state. And that's basically what it meant until the Song. And it was the Song loyalists, by refusing so openly and at such self-endangerment to serve the Yuan, that this meaning, refusal to serve the Second Dynasty, became incorporated into the meaning of the term Yimin. So this term Yimin really only applies to the governing, to the political class, because the common people had no such choice. They couldn't serve in government anyway because they didn't have the requisite education. It was only those with the requisite education who had this choice to make. And those who made the choice to not serve, they were considered during this period to be proper Yimin. But it was very difficult, really difficult, because having the protections and the income from official service were very nearly the only proper ways for Shidaifu to have sufficient income to maintain the lifestyle that was considered an incumbent on this social class.
Yeah, unless you come from a family of wealth, then it's really hard when you don't have official positions to survive, especially in this period. I think a lot of even the wealthy, right, because of the war and dislocation, they lost a lot of their wealth.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And this is a part of the great pathos of the period. Yes, there were a lot of very wealthy households either spent their wealth supporting the resistance or just lost it to plunder and take over. Their lands were simply occupied by other people and they didn't have the legal standing to get it back. It was very perilous to refuse to even take the civil service exams and become what we call a licentiate, a zhusheng or shengyuan. Why do so many people want to assume just to take the prefectural level examinations and just get that title? It gave you protections from people who might want to give your family trouble on the local level. And it was very valuable.
So how did the Qing court respond to all this? Because when you have these people who refuse to serve you, that's an attack on your legitimacy. And you've already mentioned that one of the ways the Qing ruled or controlled China in this early period was through selective brutality, but they also have to respond on an intellectual level. So how did they do that? How did they legitimize themselves to rule China and to try to bring these intellectuals within its own service?
That is, again, one of the most interesting things about the period. Of course, the Manchus weren't the only ones in the government. The Manchus had been able to take over all of China because they had, in the course of things, absorbed a lot of highly literate Han Chinese who knew something about administration and knew something about the way in which things were usually handled in the government procedures. But we have to make a big distinction here between the North and the South. North China and very large parts of Central China had really been laid waste before the Manchus came in by the what in the West we call roving rebel rebellions, the Liu Ko, so their term, or the Nomin Jiangjun, as they're called in the PRC, the peasant armies, which they were not, but which they're generally called in the PRC. So landholding, the landed, educated class of North China and a lot of Central China had just been completely terrorized and virtually wiped out. I mean, they were really desperate, if they were still alive, by the time the Manchus invaded in force in 1644. They were more than ready for any regime of whatever ethnicity that would restore order. And indeed, this is how the Manchus justified themselves in propaganda and later on in their historical judgments on the period, was that they were the saviors of China. They were saving China from the chaos of all of these rebellions. And of course, mostly they were saving the ruling elite, or they were saving the political class. in North China, that political class was really ready to join any group that would protect their properties, give them an income, give them some protection. But this was not the case in South China. And of course, South China is far more populous than North China. And South China was home to the more concentrated centers of intellectual endeavor and high culture. The lower Yangtze region, for instance, parts of Fujian and the Guangdong, Guangzhou region in far South China, but especially the lower Yangtze region and Zhejiang, these were highly populated, and that great wealth of those regions not only was a great source of tax revenue, but it also had produced a very thick intellectual class. And these were the people that the more enlightened among the Manchu leaders realized, we need to win these people over. We need to win these people over. And the Shunzhi emperor did some things, but it was still awfully early. There's still too much fighting going on during the Shunzhi reign, the first Qing reign in China proper. But you asked previously in your notes to me about the Kangxi emperor.
Right.
And this is where the real turnabout comes. He was an amazing figure. I must say the Manchus were quite either very lucky or very perceptive in their choice among the Manchu princes of who would be the succeeding ruler. And you may know the story about the Kangxi emperor, of why he was chosen at the age of just 7 years old to succeed the Shunzhi emperor when the Shunzhi emperor died very unexpectedly in 1661. He had survived smallpox. And the Manchus knew by that time that if you survived smallpox, you would not get it again. And smallpox had been absolutely killing off the Manchu elite like DDT on birds. It was a great terror, a great terror. Of course, they had lived in the far northeast where it was too cold. But once they came down into Chinese proper, they had no immune defense against this disease. And their princes were dying off one after another, not from being killed in battle, but from this disease. So they got this boy, and he had smallpox and survived. If you need to look around among portraits of the Kangxi Emperor, the one on the dust cover of Spence's book of the Emperor Kangxi is probably the most realistic. It fully shows his face and skin completely covered with pockmarks. The more formal portraits just erase that. But he was a very lucky choice. He went on to have great physical vigor, and he had a very long life. He had the longest formal reign, 61 years, of any Chinese emperor. But the main thing was that after he came into his majority at age 13, by the time he got into his 20s, even his early 20s, he was able to engineer the defeat of the most threatening internal revolt of the Manchu Qing order, the rebellion of the three feudatories in the 1670s and early 80s. He was not a passive figure in that. He was a very important figure in engineering the defeat of that tremendous threat to this young dynasty. And then, even before he had completely wiped up that problem, he took very bold steps to engage the southern Chinese elite. And he himself was intellectually a very curious person. He was very interested in all manner of learning. And this greatly impressed the Chinese elite. He absorbed traditional Chinese learning very avidly. He was also, of course, completely versed in the traditional Manchu skills. of riding and shooting and such. And so he was just wonderfully able to manage this balance between the Manchu culture and high Chinese culture. And of course, one of the most famous things that he did to engage the Southern Chinese elite was to put on this called the Boshe Hongru examination, this examination for the cream of the scholar class that took place in 1679, that just called for nominations of all the greatest thinkers of the land to come to the capital and take a pretty much pro forma examination and then accept appointments to mostly literary positions in the government. And this was a great signal to the literati class, and they concentrated on the South. If you look at the people who were selected in the Boshue Hongru examination, they're overwhelmingly scholars from South China. And this was the aim, to win over the South Chinese elite. He was quite successful in that. And then immediately after that, many of those who were chosen in that examination were assigned to a project that the Kangxi Emperor took very great interest in, and that was the obligatory compilation of the Ming history. Some of the viewers of this podcast might not know that one of the most important things in Chinese tradition to establish the legitimacy of a succeeding dynasty was to write the history of the previous dynasty. This was considered in Chinese civilization to be a very obligatory task that demonstrated the abilities and the legitimacy of the succeeding dynasty, that they could get enough scholars involved and write at least an acceptable history of the dynasty that they had conquered. And the Kangxi Emperor took very great personal interest in this project. And that also won over a great many literati. Huang Zuxi himself, although he refused to take the Boshue Hongru examination and he refused to accept any appointment to the Ming History Bureau, he was willing to donate his materials. And he had a lot, he personally wrote a lot of materials. He had a lot of books. Especially about late Ming history. They were very much in need of accurate historical materials for writing the history of the late Ming and the end of the Ming. Huang Zuxi had a lot of that. He was quite willing to give them his materials over to be copied for use. He sent his best students and his son to Beijing to work on the Ming history, and that also was a major factor in his, one might say, not reconciliation, but accommodation to Qing rule.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, the Ming history is considered the best edited of all the 24 histories of China, especially when you compare it to the history of the Yuan, which was rushed, and the history of the Song, which had a lot of mistakes. The Ming histories, it's just really pleasant to read.
I think a lot of the credit for the quality of the Ming history actually goes to Huang Zuxi's best student, Wan Sitong. He personally also would not accept official appointment, but he was so valuable in the work of the Ming history that the successive compilers of the Ming all just reached into their own pockets and paid for him to live in either their own homes or in the Huiguan in Beijing, just to keep him there and keep him working. And he died on the job up there, but he never accepted official appointment. But a lot, especially the biographies in the Ming, he took special credit for those, a lot of credit for the quality of the treatises on calendrics and astronomy. That a lot of that is credited to the expertise of Huang Zunxi's most talented scholar son, Huang Baijia. Yeah, it is considered one of the better ones, but it's also, I think, for better and for worse, in the fact that it took a really long time to produce. It was felt to be so incumbent on the new dynasty to do this history of the Ming that actually the Ming History Project was started up in 1645, but they couldn't get anybody to help with it in 1645. And the people they appointed to head it up were just totally hated and rejected by the Han Chinese elite. And so it couldn't go anywhere then. And so it kind of stumbled along, but then it really got rolling under the Kangxi Emperor, because he was able to bring in and satisfy the Han Chinese intellectuals that this is a legitimate ruler. This is a legitimate ruler. And under him, they could do good intellectual work without compromising themselves too badly. But even under the Kangxi Emperor, I mean, the written record that they solicited, and the Kangxi Emperor was right out there saying, don't worry, we need your materials. We need your materials, especially on the late Ming, because so many records from official records from the late Ming had been lost. The imperial palace was almost completely burned down in the rebel takeover of Beijing before the Manchus came in. So just tremendous loss of the archival record of the very last Ming reigns, not to mention the Ming courts that continued on in the south for 20 or 30 years. So they terribly needed private scholars to donate or lend their materials to this project. And so the Kangxi Emperor was right out there saying, don't worry, you won't get tripped up for any pejorative reference to the Manchus here or there, any negative comments on the putative ancestors of the Manchus, the Jurchens of your period. Don't worry, we won't persecute anybody for any of these little problems that might appear in the materials that you submit. And he was good on that promise for most of his reign. But they were just desperate for materials and for qualified scholars to work on this history. But they couldn't. There are all kinds of disagreements over interpretation, disagreements over inclusion or exclusion of material, and all of those things that go into a large collective project about a very controversial period. And this is a great lesson for historians to pay attention to the passing of generations. Because as long as the people who had actually lived through the mid-Chinese century and the fall of the dynasty and the Qing conquest, as long as they were still alive and could stand up and gainsay what was being written, it was very difficult for the Ming history compilation to come to any agreement about interpretation of the end of the Ming. But then you see that when you get to the turn of the 18th century into the 18th century, very few people from that time still living. Then you start finding that the court is able to come around to just validating certain interpretations and saying, this is what we're going to say about it. I guess there's nobody still alive to raise objections and say, I was there and I know that this is not true. And of course, there are analogies to that in our own history as well. It's no coincidence that all of this neo-Nazism and Holocaust denial is raising its ugly head at a time when the people who lived to survive the Third Reich and who survived the Holocaust, they're mostly all dead by now. Before, when they were still alive and kicking, you couldn't deny what they had been through. And now that they're mostly dead, you find all of these nutheads standing up and saying, no, it was all fake.
Yeah, it's a very unfortunate situation. In our final few minutes, we've been talking a lot about men, right? These male intellectual figures, but we know that women also played a huge role in intellectual life, as Dorothy Coe's book so wonderfully showed us, there were a lot of educated women. So I was just wondering, what role did women play in the intellectual culture of this period?
Yeah, a very important underlying circumstance in all of this, and this tremendous profusion of writings about this period. It wouldn't have been possible if not for the great development of literacy in China among really all classes of people, especially since the Middle Ming. And so the 17th century is very much, to large extent, a product of the fruition of the spread of literacy. And it affected all genders and all classes. And women, there was a very definite rise in women's literacy. It became quite common that women of the upper classes, particularly, that they have at least functional literacy to be able to keep accounts and run basic affairs of the household. But for the high literati class, people of a very high level of literacy, it became important that the women of the household be able to read at least the Sun Zijing and to be able to compose at least some poetry, to write letters to other women, or even to be able to read the letters that their husbands would send home. We all know that for the literati class, the men were almost never home. Either they were serving as officials, or their cultural activities took them away from home, or they were serving as teachers in other people's families away from home. The women, they had to be able to read the letters that their husbands sent home about what was going on, and instructions from their husbands about what to do about family affairs when their husbands were away, but also just the idea of companionate marriage. When the husband was home, the idea that a wife should be able to share with him in the pleasures of poetry exchange and other literary arts like calligraphy and painting, discussion of certain texts, and certainly that women of a highly educated household, it was important that they at least had some knowledge of the classical texts that prescribe women's proper comportment. So this became quite desirable in potential brides or literati sons. Also, it was very important that the wives be able to serve as preschool teachers for especially the sons, to some extent the daughters, but especially the sons. It was the wives and the concubines to some extent, but especially the wives, because they were chosen often for their, at least partly for their learning, that they be able to get the very young children, teach them their ABCs, and get them to be able to recite the San Zijing and things like that before they started their formal schooling. This is considered a very important role for a woman in a literati household. And women started having, although they still were quite sequestered and couldn't leave their domestic space very often or very easily, and they started, well, having little poetry groups, women's poetry groups, and having women's epistolary associations. Ellen Widmer has written a good deal about the epistolary world of women's letters that they exchanged, which was even more important during and in the wake of the conquest, because so many families became scattered. And these women who had known each other before became only able to maintain ties through letter writing. And of course, the courtesan scene was very famous, especially the Qinhuai quarter of Nanjing, the southern capital. A number of some of the most famous courtesans of Chinese history emerged during this period and were regarded as very much the intellectual equals of some true glitterati of the time. Of course, the most famous is Liu Shi or Liu Ruxi, who eventually was taken he actually tried to take her as his formal wife, even though his regular wife was still alive, by Chen Qianyi. And there was a great story of their relationship. And some of them became very famous Ming loyalists and supported the resistance. And it was a very famous and dramatic period for the courtesan scene. Now, then what happened? A whole lot of women lost their lives along with their menfolk during the conquest. And if they didn't lose their own lives, they were left to cope with the great difficulties of widowhood in traditional China, pre-modern China, in the conditions of a ruined economy and ongoing political upset and chaos and uncertainty. And so there emerged from this many biographies of virtuous women, either virtuous because they committed suicide along with their husbands, or committed suicide rather than being violated by conquering soldiers. And then the women who survived as widows, many biographies of these virtuous widows who were able to cope with great difficulty and persevere and raise their sons' property to become officials in the new Qing order. So a lot of writing about women and a lot of writing by women. Now, with the conservative turn in the early Qing, there was also a conservative turn to women's lives. High literacy in women continued to be valued. And actually, the middle Qing and high Qing and going into late Qing was a tremendous period for the production of women's poetry. But the high Qing was also the height of, in all of Chinese history, the height of restriction on women's movements, women's engagement in anything outside the family. Female sequestration reached its greatest stringency also in the middle Qing period. So it's, as always, countervailing trends in history.
I see. Yeah, I think the role of women tends to be somewhat understated when we talk about intellectual development. But fortunately, there's a lot of scholarship now that are starting to shed light just on how important of a role they played in the intellectual scene and also in the family, allowing the men to, the male literati, to do what they do.
Absolutely. Huang Zuxi, again, to take Huang Zuxi as an example, his father was very brutally murdered under the eunuch regime of the Tianqi period when Huang himself was just 14 years old. And his father, of course, became a tremendous figure of memory for him, but absolutely equal with the influence of his father on Huang Zongxi's greatness in his later life and his own perseverance and determination and commitment to survive and make a difference in the world in spite of constrictions was his mother. He was, after his father's death, he was the eldest son. He was by far the eldest of five sons. And so with his father's death, and then not long after that, the death of his grandfather, he became the head of family. And at the age of 21, he became the head of this struggling family. They'd lost so much of their property even before the conquest because of the confiscation by the state, because of his father's opposition to the eunuch regime. And so after that, it was Huang and his mother, and they were tight and they held together. And he attributes so much of his family's survival to his mother and her qualities of being so down to earth and matter of fact, and let's just deal with the situation and keep going. And he learned a lot of those qualities of perseverance from her and admired them tremendously in her. She lived to be over 80 years old, well over 80. I mean, he died at 83 or something. And so she was a model for him. And he was very devoted to her for almost his whole life. He lived to be 85, and he outlived his mother by only about 10 years.
Wow.
So they were a team, and he was very devoted to her. And without her, I just don't know whether we would have had the Ming Yi Dai Fang Lu, the Ming Ru Xuan, the Ming Wenhai. What, I don't know what would have happened to Huang Zongxi without his mother.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. We are, I guess, at an hour, and we've covered so much about the intellectual history of this period, which I think, given all the political chaos, the warfare that goes on, a lot of people fixate on that. It's certainly interesting, but also the intellectual things that are going on are just as interesting, but I think not a lot of people are paying attention to that. I just want to thank you again, Professor Stu, for coming to the podcast and sharing your wonderful insight on this period and the intellectual production, the cultural production that was going on. So I hope people have a better sense of not just the war, but also the culture.
Yes, thanks for this opportunity. I hope I was somewhat coherent. And
oh, it was great. It was great.
And I hope people will continue to take interest in the period.
Absolutely. That concludes our interview. Thank you so much for listening to the Chinese History Podcast.